From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our Real Talk segment dismisses notions of a post-racial America and offers solutions to closing the racial wealth gap. Then, explaining a method of conflict resolution in use in law enforcement.
At the heart of verbal defense and influence, we are trying to treat people with dignity by showing them respect.
A Milwaukee mother remembers her late son in a book that chronicles her journey through grief. And why one local tennis school thinks the mental part of the game is as important as the backhand.
You can't control whether or not you win every single point, obviously. But what you can control is your body language. What you can control is how you talk to yourself internally after good and after bad points.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. When President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative was first announced in February, it emphasized its goal to improve opportunities for young men of color. In the months that followed, the program's task force has met with public and private organizations that work with these young men to gauge recommendations, and last month it put out a call for mentors in communities across the country. Yet as it's made incremental progress, the initiative has also come under fire. Last week, senior Obama aide Valerie Jarrett responded to criticism that the program excludes young women of color. Now, two economists are saying My Brother's Keeper focuses too much on the behaviors of young men and is essentially blaming the victims rather than addressing the real structural causes of racial inequality. Dr. William Darity is a professor of public policy studies, African American studies, and economics at Duke University. Dr. Derek Hamilton is an associate professor at the Milano, the New School of International Affairs, and a research fellow at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. They join contributor David Pate in the studio for the latest installment of Real Talk. Hamilton begins by telling Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce that the initiative's error is emblematic of a society that wants to minimize the impact of discrimination.
We're in a paradigm that moves us away from discourse on racial inequality with the use of exceptions of black success and other anecdotes that, you know, the term that is commonly used now is post-racial. So that we say that there might be barriers that were a legacy that lead to poverty, but beyond that, discriminatory effects associated with race are marginal or non-existent.
Yeah.
And so that's the paradigm.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've heard someone say, well, you know, look at how wealthy LeBron James or Oprah Winfrey is. Mm-hmm. Well, there can't be any barriers to success for black folks in America now.
Where do we see that? I mean, you've given us a great example there, but where else do we see that? I mean, maybe at the policy level that's really impacting whether we're actually addressing these racial inequalities.
From the White House itself. Seems like all of the ideas that are aimed at addressing racial inequality aren't aimed at addressing structural things like discrimination, but rather attitudes, norms, and behaviors amongst blacks themselves or other subaltern populations themselves. The most prominent one right now is My Brother's Keeper, which is really trying to make, you know, it's not aimed at addressing labor market discrimination, but rather making black boys become better black men.
Yeah, the whole issue of respectability, the politics of respectability seems to be very prominent in My Brother's Keeper. And I really appreciate the fact that you did bring that into your most recent article in Dissent about the whole idea that we're not addressing the issue of the keeper, we're addressing the issue of the victim in terms of this whole blaming the victim mentality that started in the 60s. And did you want to kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Explain this a little further. So the idea here is that we're blaming people for their behaviors, how they manage their money, choices that they make, versus looking at real issues like structural
exactly.
racism and a lack of
yes.
perhaps opportunities, a lack of historic wealth gathering.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would like to talk about the phenomenon of discrimination and its ongoing significance. The first thing I want to observe is, you know, people frequently make the claim that there's an oppositional attitude towards education that is held by many blacks. But if you look carefully at what the evidence is, if you take into account any black individual's household socioeconomic status, that is the income and education of their parents, that black individual is more likely to get more years of schooling and more credentials than a white individual who comes from a family with a similar set of resources. So for given family resources, blacks actually demonstrate more of an achievement orientation with respect to education than whites do. Now, that's the first observation I want to make. The second is that the payoff for educational attainment remains lower for blacks than for whites. One key example is associated with the fact that at each level of educational attainment, the black unemployment rate nationally is twice as high as the white unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate for blacks who have some college education or an associate's degree is higher than the unemployment rate for whites who have not completed high school. One last comment, which is specific to the state of Wisconsin. A sociologist, Diva Pager, did a field experiment, and she conducted the field experiment in the city of Milwaukee. And she found that white males with a criminal record were more likely to get a callback for a job than black males with no criminal record when they are of a similar age and similar educational status.
So, you know, we have examples of the rhetoric around inequality that if people would take more responsibility, take initiative, don't seem to support the empirical data. And unfortunately, a lot of the policies that are coming about are aimed at or based on the rhetoric and not on the realities of really what's driving inequality.
If we're turning these kinds of thought processes on their heads, if we need to stop blaming the victim, as so many of these policies are based on, what then is causing this inequality?
The key indicator that needs a lot more attention is wealth. The resources that wealth give you allow you opportunities in the labor market, allow you opportunities to generate education, allow you basically access and opportunity to almost any field of human endeavor. And if we look at initial wealth, we can see that racial inequality is most disparate in that outcome. Right?
What do we mean when we say wealth, though?
So net worth, what you own, your asset, it goes beyond income. Income is a flow that you get periodically. Wealth is a stock, your savings. Especially in a capitalist society where capital becomes more important, it is your accumulated resources. That's what we mean by wealth. So a technical definition would be the total value of your assets minus the total value of your debt.
And what do we look like currently as a country in terms of, if you look at the racial wealth gap? I've heard that term. People have heard that term. And you guys have talked about that term. So how would you, for our audience, how would you define what that looks like? I don't know if everyone understands when they hear racial wealth gap. How does it really look between a black, white, or Latino, whoever, whatever, however you want to explain it today?
What it looks like is complete disparity. The typical black household has about 6 cents for every dollar as a typical white household. The absolute wealth gap exceeds $100,000. And if we look at things like, suppose we exclude home ownership and just look at liquid assets, so the ability to get resources in a fairly quick manner. If we look at that, blacks are virtually penniless. The typical black household has $25 in liquid assets when you exclude retirement savings. If you add retirement savings, the figure goes up to $200. Now, we know that $200 can do very little if you're faced with a financial crisis or any type of emergency. In comparison, the typical white household has about $23,000 when you include retirement savings and $3,000 when you don't include retirement savings, which is over 100 times the amount that the typical black household has. So the disparities are stark. And then I mentioned earlier that we're in a paradigm where we like to believe that we've overcome race and to a large extent, that there's no real structural barriers holding groups behind because we turn to exceptionals like the president himself and say, well, a black man became president, so there's really not much barriers holding black people back. So consistent with that type of narrative, the explanations become, well, black people don't save. Well, black people are short-sightedness, or they make poor choices. They choose the wrong investment. But the prevailing wisdom from the economic literature with regards to savings is that once you control for income, if anything, black households have a marginally higher savings rate. Not a large amount, but if anything, they would save more than your typical white household. And again, that's controlling for income. So let me just conclude real quick because I'm being long-winded. But basically, the rhetoric does not support the reality. And again, the problem is that policies are directed at the rhetoric and not the reality. If we really want to address structural racial inequality, we need policies to address the reality.
So the idea of improving financial literacy among blacks, that doesn't seem to actually address what the problems are here.
First of all, the notion that improving financial literacy would close the racial wealth gap presumes that everyone is receiving similar amounts of inherited resources across generations. And that's not the case. In fact, the inherited inequalities are actually aggravated not only by differences in the amounts of resources that people receive when their relatives die, but also the amounts of resources that are transferred to them from their relatives while the relatives are still living. There are vast racial differences in the amounts of resources that get transferred across generations. And that accounts for most of the racial wealth gap, not poor savings decisions or ignorance on the part of blacks who are attempting to accumulate wealth. That's not the key issue. I would say this, you know, that the real issue is not financial literacy, but the lack of initial finance.
One thing you both said that I find intriguing, because I even did this kind of a poll with my family members, we talked about this issue of home ownership. So we wanted to see amongst our own relatives under the age of 50, who had their own home, you know, and to see, are most people renting? Because we never really thought about it. And between 100 people, only 4 people in my family own their home, me being one of them.
You know, black people peaked in home ownership prior to the collapse in the mortgage market. And that peak was still well below the white home ownership rate. At the peak, we owned about close to 45%. That was the typical home ownership rate for families, a little under 45%. Now it's about 41%. In comparison, I believe the white rate hovers around 70 or 72%, something like that. That's on a nationwide basis. Most Americans, period, have the largest stock of their wealth and assets is home ownership. What's really underneath inequality and wealth is not necessarily home ownership per se. It is access to capital to purchase an asset that's going to appreciate over time. And it doesn't necessarily have to be home ownership. So again, let me try to make this point a little clearer. When people are young adults, you might have some groups of individuals that have access to some type of endowment either through inheritance or, as Sandy mentioned earlier, an in vivo transfer that allows them to purchase an asset that's going to appreciate over their lifetime. Other individuals don't have access to that capital to purchase that asset, whether it's home ownership, stock ownership, purchasing a business, or what have you. It is the security in an asset that's going to appreciate over a lifetime that really gives you economic security. You know, we like to think, and the rhetoric is, well, it's those individuals who are better savers, those people who take income and put it aside. Well, I'd say that that's a little misleading. What it really is getting into the ownership game of some asset.
And that's hard to do if that isn't being passed down from generation to generation to begin with.
That's exactly right. That's one of the key sources of structural inequality. So if we want policies to lead to a society where we really have at least close to a meritocracy, then we really have to arm individuals with some chip so that they can play in the game of capitalism. If you have no chip in the game, then you're basically structured for low levels of resource accumulation.
So what policies can we put in place to give everybody that chip to begin with?
For quite a while, Derek and I have been talking about a proposal that we call the Baby Bonds Initiative. The idea is that the federal government would provide each newborn infant with an endowment or a trust fund at the time of their birth, and the amount of the endowment or trust fund would be adjusted or graduated on the basis of the wealth position of the child's family. For children who are born into families at the lower end of the wealth distribution, we'd give them a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund at the point of their birth. And these would be funds that could be accessed by the young people at the point where they reach adulthood, say age 18 or so. If we decided as a society collectively that we wanted to limit what they could do with those funds, perhaps constrain them to be used for educational purposes or to assist them in starting their own small business. We could do that. But the idea is to give each child an initial foundation or basis for having the capacity to acquire the types of assets that Derek was talking about earlier that would give them the capacity to have a decent wealth position over the course of their lifetime.
I can't imagine, given our current Congress that seems obsessed with austerity measures, that this would be something that would actually catch on, though.
Well, this wouldn't be that expensive, actually, in the grand scheme of things. Suppose you had 4 million babies that are born in a year. If the mean amount of the trust fund was $20,000, then the cost of the program for the initial cohort would be $80,000. I'm sorry, $80 billion.
That would be really cheap.
That would be really good. $80 billion. But $80 billion is actually not a very large share of the overall federal budget.
You've been talking about rhetoric, and one of the things I hear a lot is, well, this is an issue about class. This isn't an issue about race. Is that dangerous to use that line of thinking when we're looking at some of these inequalities?
Well, I'd say it's just inaccurate. There is a class dimension to the wealth gap, without a doubt, but there's also a racial dimension, which is even larger than the class dimension. We know it at every level of class. If you look at income by quintiles or deciles, we know that the racial wealth gap is enormous. So within income class, you find that Black and Latino households have a mere fraction of what their white peers would in that same income class. I'll give you another statistic that is very, I think, enlightening to the dimension of race. We know that head of households who graduated from college that happen to be Black, their family's wealth position is typically lower than families whose head of household is white and dropped out of high school.
Wow.
So clearly class cannot explain the dimensions of inequality by race with regards to the wealth gap.
Yeah, actually, the wealth gap gets worse as you move down the income distribution.
Yeah, but again, we've proposed solutions. So we recognize that there are asset-poor white individuals that would be beneficial if they had access to capital at a key point in their life to build their assets.
Yeah.
So we've categorized programs which John Powell at University of California, Berkeley, has called targeted universalism. They're universal, but they're targeted at addressing structural inequality.
Sandy, Derek, David, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having this show.
Dr. William Sandy Darity is a professor of public policy studies, African American studies, and economics at Duke University. Dr. Derek Hamilton is an associate professor at Milano, the New School of International Affairs, and a research fellow at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. The pair co-authored the report Beyond Broke, Why Closing the Racial Wealth Gap is a Priority for National Economic Security. It's published by Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative. They'll also publish an article entitled From a Tangle of Pathology to a Race Fair America in the summer 2014 issue of Dissent magazine. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce and Real Talk contributor David Pate, who is an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. Coming up next, a better way to resolve conflict. A Milwaukee company believes it has an answer. We'll hear about it next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We all have examples of when conflict resolution goes wrong. We yell at the customer service representative at the credit card company, or the cashier snaps at you for bringing 12 items into the 10 items or fewer checkout lane. But we know, or well, we should know, that unpleasant conflict can be handled more adeptly. A former Milwaukee radio host is adapting a conflict resolution model for law enforcement to help people in other fields better manage these situations. Ben Marins is with the Milwaukee-based Vistalar Group, which uses a technique called verbal defense and influence. He joins me in the studio now to explain. Thanks so much for being here.
Bonnie, a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Verbal defense and influence training. Let's start with what it is and what it was initially intended to do and then how it's being used now. So what is the assumptions underneath verbal defense and influence training?
At the heart of this, Bonnie, is the fact that conflict happens. So we can try to avoid it. In the Midwest, we're really good at putting our heads in the sand when things get rough, but it's really not the healthiest way to deal with it. Verbal defense and influence is designed to help people cope with conflict by A, getting them to realize it will happen, you can deal with it, and you don't have to end up enemies with those you are in conflict with, because most of the people we have a conflict with are friends and family and coworkers. So we just deal with our conflict. Verbal defense and influence began about 30 years ago as a police and law enforcement training tool. So the police officer who had to deal with someone who was going 40 and a 20 didn't have to open the door and, you know, yell at them and tell them, give me your license, give me your registration. Say there's a universal greeting that goes with this. So the police officer was taught to say, good afternoon, miss. My name is Officer Marins, and I noticed you were going about 45 miles an hour, and this is a 20-mile-an-hour zone. So first of all, I want to ask you, is everything okay? Are you rushing to an emergent situation? No, officer, I wasn't paying attention. I'm sorry. Okay, well, what I need to do is look at your license and registration and then talk with you a little bit. I may have to give you a ticket, and I'll try to do this as quickly as possible. Are you ready to give me your license and registration? So in that universal greeting, the officer is taught to identify him or herself, explain why they stopped you, and get you to buy into this by asking you, do you understand it, and then asking, are you ready to proceed and go forward?
This kind of conflict resolution, this kind of approach to resolving conflict, how is this different from other forms that are taught?
You know, not being an expert in all the forms, I don't know. I know at the heart of verbal defense and influence is that we are trying to treat people with dignity by showing them respect. That's what we've taught to the law enforcement. This has been expanded now. The Vistalar Group, who I work for here in Milwaukee now, trains people all over the country, law enforcement, healthcare workers, corporate America, and schools to help fight bullying. In fact, for healthcare, you'll find the research shows nurses are 5 times more likely and medical people to be attacked or hurt on the job because of the conflict that can arise.
And you're talking not necessarily from patients, but say from family members or others?
Anybody that come in conflict. It could be the patient or could be the family member brought the patient in. And this training has been in place at Children's Hospital here in Milwaukee by the Vistalar Group. Verbal defense and influence in the past 6 months has gotten the attacks on healthcare people, children's, from over 100 a year ago to zero in the first 6 months of the year. So it does work because in part, you're training me and you how to be better with our conflict. And with the idea that if we manage our conflict and someone comes at us in conflict, we are able to help bring them down in part by example and in part by the idea that I'm going to show you dignity, I'm going to treat you with respect, and we're going to feel better about the clash we've had because it's about the clash and not about each other.
What happens in a situation? How are you taught to deal with something where somebody doesn't respond to you in that way? If somebody, say, is, you know, doped up, or somebody is in a situation where they simply can't respond rationally, how does this training help you when you're in that situation?
At the heart of verbal defense and influence, in addition to the universal greeting I spoke about, they also teach us that there is something called showtime. It is the face we present. You right now are looking at me with the face of a talk show host. And if you've had a bad day, it would not be proper in your role right now to put any of that on the table in front of me. So we have a face we bring to the situation. And then we have some tools we call the 5 maxims to try to get you to treat people with dignity by showing them respect by following these 5 rules. The first one is to listen to others from head to toe. So it's almost beyond active listening. So you're engaged with me right now. You're looking at me. You're thinking about what I'm saying. You are letting me know by the way you responded to me that you're hearing me. The second maxim is to ask people for your help or cooperation. Don't tell them to do something. And by asking, again, it's dignified. You're not ordering them. You can get them to buy in. The third maxim is to explain why. When you show somebody the context of what's being done, it will often diffuse conflict because people will understand what's going on. Sometimes it's just fear of lack of understanding that causes us to not want to do something or fear or question why we're being asked to do it. The fourth maxim is to offer options. So when you present somebody with options, giving them choice gives them dignity too. And then the fifth maxim, and I think it's my favorite because it recognizes we're all human, and that's to give a second chance because we don't always succeed the first time. So that fifth maxim is to understand being human, we fail.
What happens, though, if you're in a situation that is life-threatening, say, and you don't have a lot of time on your side? How do these maxims work in sort of that contracted time frame?
I'm glad you asked. Conflict happens. So when we teach, our main trainer, a guy named Gary Klugowitz, who was a Milwaukee County Sheriff, teaches people that we have a concept in schools with fire drills and not fire talks. And the reason he says that is we practice how we get out of the house or the school if there's a fire. How are you going to handle conflict when it happens? You practice this. So you actually, in our classes on tape, will be asked to deal with someone like that. You've got to practice those five maxims. And when the heat of battle's going, how are you going to react? It's a muscle memory, a mental muscle memory, if you will, that I've practiced this. I know when somebody gets mad, the first thing I do is, they call it stacking your blocks. I sit up straight. I take a deep breath. And then the time I'm taking that deep breath, I'm thinking, what's in front of me and what's the first thing I'm going to do to react to it? But again, we don't teach conflict management with kids, with bullying, or with people in the workplace. We just kind of find ways to strut off and be frustrated. And then the conflict just builds and it comes out some other way.
How long does a typical training period last? If an organization brings you in to do this, what kind of time are people are looking at?
Well, I can briefly go through it with you in a 10-minute interview. We do half-day seminars, full-day seminars, and then there's a week-long course. And the company has been in Fort Hood down in Texas this last week doing a full week of training, and they have signed on for all 50,000 MPs and their families to take part in this. So the longest training is about 4 days, and we also have an online course, so you can take that at your own pace. But the idea is that it's not a semester. And it's not beyond the reach of anybody. It's just something that we need to recognize. A, conflict happens. B, I want to handle it better or sort of fall victim to it. Instead of struggling through the conflict for a couple of days before you finally resolve it and get where you're going with your project at work, with whether it be at the city or WWM, the idea that you can resolve that conflict with respect and dignity in a short period of time, so it's more efficient and overall a healthier way to deal with each other. Toughest place for me to do it? At home with my wife and daughter, because the emotional energies are higher. But these techniques have worked there too.
I was going to ask about that because, again, when you're really invested in something, we as human beings tend to stick to our position, whatever that position might be, whether it's a good position or a bad position. And so I think a lot of this kind of training, you have to be willing to say to yourself, you know what, I might be wrong here. How do you get people to do that? Because we tend not to want to do that. And that's all of us.
I practice something that I call the theory of four faces. It's about empathy and trying to figure out where the other person is coming from. And in my mind, we come from four faces. Our first face is the child's face. So when I look at you, or if I'm just hearing you, I try to picture your six-year-old. Because a six-year-old is pretty much who we are throughout our lives. It changes some, but I'm trying to become empathetic to the other person. So first and foremost, what's your six-year-old look like? Then what's your 60, 70, or 80-year-old look like? I call that the face of wisdom, because none of us make it through this world in 5, 6, or 7 decades without gaining a lot of wisdom. The third face is probably my favorite face. It's the face of joy, or the happiest face, because when you're on the air doing what you're doing as a host and doing it well, you've gotten married or you've scored the winning run, whatever it is that brings the joy to your face, that's the one I want to see, because we all want people to feel that way. And when you talk about people you know who never show that face, God, they're so grumpy, they're so difficult, that's the face I work the hardest at to see in the people who don't show it. And the fourth face I see is the face of character, of intestinal fortitude, the face when you're so depressed you can't get out of bed, you've just buried a loved one, and you wonder, how are you going to get up and do it all over again? How are you going to move forward? And yet most of us have gone there, and most of us have gotten up. Seeing those four faces in someone allows you to empathize and try to understand where they're coming from.
How did you get interested in this? You made quite a switch in career.
You know, it was a process. I was on the air practicing this. I was hearing people. I was having to be empathetic, enjoying it, but that was what my job. Hear what they had to say and follow up. When we're dealing with others in conflict, we need to hear what they have to say and follow up. So it's really a natural progression. It's just my studio is a different place, if you will. And in the last 10 years of the 20 I spent at Wisconsin Public Radio, I spent time away from the studio doing a lot of public speaking and training. So it was sort of a natural progression to say, this is what I've learned as a journalist in 30 years. And I can teach you the same principles of listening and empathy that are then going to help you resolve your conflict.
Ben Marins, it's great to have you back on the air.
Nice to be here, Bonnie. Appreciate it.
Ben Marins is with the Milwaukee-based Vistalar Group, which teaches conflict resolution through verbal defense and influence. He formerly hosted a program across town at Wisconsin Public Radio. There are links to more about Vistalar Group and verbal defense and influence at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break now, and then a new book chronicles the loss of losing a son and the ways his family found to celebrate and honor him. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. On a Sunday morning in February 2008, Wisconsin native Matt Monger Lynch was killed after being struck by a van during a bicycle race in Chicago. He was 29 years old. A chef, a cyclist, an outdoorsman, an adventurer, he left behind his parents, his brother, a wife, and family and friends across the globe. The pain of his loss was especially deep for his mother, Barbara Monger, which she heart-wrenchingly describes in her book, Writing Through Grief. But the book is also about how her family dealt with their loss by finding unique ways to honor Matt and his memory, not the least of which is the book itself. Indeed, readers will come to know who Matt really was through his mother's words. Yet Monger tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce she never intended to write it.
I didn't decide to write a book. A friend of mine, Judy Bridges, was talking to me and asked me if I were going to write something about Matt. And I said, no, I really hadn't thought of it. And this was maybe 8 or 9 months after his death. And after she asked me that, I thought, well, maybe I will write something, not with the intent of publishing it, but just for my own sake. So I started writing and I kept writing. And it was healing and it was wonderful to remember these things about Matt that I had kind of forgotten, you know, incidents from his childhood and from his teenage years. And reviewing those memories was really meaningful and helpful to me. And I think it also helped me come to terms with the stark reality of his absence. And she then told me, and so did a couple of others who read what I had written, said that they thought it would be helpful for others to read about this and that it might be healing and, you know, have some of the same benefits that it had for me when I wrote it.
Yet you emphasize this isn't a how-to book of how to get through your grief when you've experienced the loss. This is your personal experience.
That's right. And it's completely not a how-to-do-it book. And there are plenty of those. But this really isn't that at all. And I couldn't tell somebody how to do it. But this is really how I did it and how my family grieved. And I think reading about that might be of benefit to others who are experiencing grief and loss. So, I mean, if it helped just one person, I'm very happy that I went ahead and made it into a book.
Even though it's couched, obviously, in the process of your grief and in the aftermath of his loss, you really get a sense of who Matt was throughout the book. Tell us a little bit more about your son.
Well, he was a high-energy kid, and he was a high-energy adult, and I'm glad that that came through in the book. He was just a bright, shining light, and I think it says in the book something like when he walked into a room or burst into a room, you really noticed it. You noticed his energy, and I'm very glad that he found a career, which was cooking, after college, that he could put his creative energies into, and he did with full force. And I was really proud of him.
He also touched so many people. I mean, this wasn't someone who had a small group of friends. He had friends flung through all corners of the globe. Mm-hmm. Was that helpful to you when all of these people came together in the aftermath of his death?
Yes, it was really helpful. I don't think we could have gotten through it without that, because he had some great friends, and some I hadn't met until then. And I then could see why they were his friends. And, you know, some of them had that same energy that he had, and not necessarily that they were cooks. He had a wide range of friends. And, you know, I really like that he made friends with lots of people, including the Dominicans who worked in some of the kitchens where he was doing the cooking.
Was that strange for you? You know, at one point in the book, you talk about how one of his friends said to you, you knew his whole life, whereas for many of his friends, it was just a part of his life. Mm-hmm. But was it strange for you, even after his death, to meet some of these people and learn about these parts of him that you maybe didn't know about?
Yeah, well, it was, some of it was surprising, and it was fun for me to know these stories. I mean, you know, of course, when a child leaves home, you don't know the full story. You get the sanitized versions. But I loved hearing the stories. You know, a number of them I've written down, and some of them came in letters from people that, you know, knew about his accident and wrote to me some memory of him. And so a couple of those are in the book, you know, some of the pretty special ones, and others were great but didn't come in time to be included in the book. And the friend who said that, it's Mary Stearns, I thought it was a wonderful comment. There was something so gratifying about it that I knew his whole life, but I didn't know some parts of it, which was good.
Good for a mother's heart to maybe not know.
Yes.
Now, obviously, these memories were very helpful for you, it seems, in your process. But there was a point where you talked about just feeling cold, almost numb. Mm-hmm. Talk about your process of grieving. We hear so much, like you said before, about how people grieve in general. But what was your experience?
Well, it's a terrible experience. And I think our society doesn't really recognize grief, and we don't talk about death. And so when it comes upon you, you know, you don't really have a way to deal with it, I think. So, well, one of the things that helped a lot was my husband and I walked a lot, and we walked and walked and walked. And I think that was really beneficial, the physical, you know, just engagement of putting one foot forward and then the next foot and keeping on going, which is kind of a metaphor for how you have to do it.
Another thing that seemed to help you and your husband, Bill, were these two phrases that you kept repeating to each other that became almost like a mantra.
Yeah, for it, you was. Both. It was. It was because we would say these two sentences over and over again. I would always say to Bill, well, how are we going to do this? And he would say, we are doing it. And so I think, you know, Bill was really a rock in this situation, and he had to be the strong person for everyone, the rest of the family. You know, I think his grieving came later, but he was able to provide that sort of strength and stability and reassurance that we needed.
How did you both avoid going down those thought paths, the whys, the how could this happen? You talked at a certain point in the book about thinking about the driver who hit Matt. How did you stop yourself from going down those roads?
Well, I think that the main thing that we did was think of positive things that we could do that would honor Matt. And that was a big, big help. And I don't know how we decided to do that, but one of the first of those, and this was not a happy occasion at all, but his bike team that he rode with called the Cutton Crew, a few weeks after the accident, organized a ride in Chicago from a park near Matt's house to the site of the accident. And friends came from all around, and the bike team arranged to have a ghost bike, which is a white painted bike that is a symbol of someone who's been killed in a bike accident. And it's a symbol used worldwide. There are several around Milwaukee that I've seen. That was attached to a little cart, and the fellow that used to ride with Matt led this procession, pulling the cart and the bike through the streets of Chicago to the scene of the accident, where we attached the bike to a kind of a bike rack with a sign with Matt's name on it. And there was something so symbolic and important about doing that. And from there, we did other, well, some were rites and rituals that honored Matt and also that healed us at the same time and One of those was on the anniversary of his death. We went out to Wyoming, where my son Luke lives, and because Matt had done some dog sledding in northern Minnesota and absolutely loved it, we decided on that day to do a dog sled ride up through this Hoback Canyon. And it was a wonderful experience, and I think that we kind of touched Matt's spirit.
There was one project that you worked on in memory of Matt in particular that you said mm-hmm. really had a cathartic effect on not only you, but on Luke, Matt's older brother.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was a shelter for hikers that we built along with volunteers from the surrounding area who are supporters of the scenic North Country Trail, which it's a wonderful trail that starts at the Adirondack Mountains and Lake Champlain in the state of New York and extends to North Dakota, to the plains. And it connects with the Missouri River and the historic Lewis and Clark Trail. And the parts that my family and I have hiked on are in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. So we found this spot along with a great guy who organizes the North Country Trail volunteers in that area, which is Baraga County, and found this wonderful site on the Sturgeon River. And all of these volunteers and members of our family and friends participated in building this shelter. And it's open for any hikers to come in and spend the night or just to get away from the big mosquitoes during the day. It has four bunks, and this summer I'm going to go up there with copies of the book and put them in a metal box in the shelter so that people can either read the book there or take it with them as they go on their hike. So it was a place that Matt loved, and I think he'd love to go to this shelter. You know, my hope is that people would read this, people who are grieving, people who've lost a loved one, and say, well, hey, I could do this in memory of this person, and to not end memorializing after the funeral or the service.
You describe several instances in the book where one of Matt's friends or a family member, one of your own friends, really reached out to you and your family, Matt's wife, Elizabeth, and came up with projects that really were about him, that kind of captured his spirit. Why were these instances, these attempts to reach out, helpful to you?
Well, it's so meaningful because I think most people are afraid to say something. They're afraid they're going to make you feel sad. Well, you already feel sad. You know, they're not going to make you feel any worse by anything that they would say. So, you know, I just valued people acknowledging what had happened and feeling comfortable enough to say something or to do something meaningful.
Eventually, you talk about how his older brother and his wife have a baby. Matt's wife has a child with her partner. People moving not on, but forward with their lives. Was there ever a point where you felt like you hadn't quite gotten to that point yet where you could really move forward?
Well, I think I have moved forward. I can be happy and I can have fun and participate in life. And, you know, I'm not sure I thought that was ever going to happen. And to see, you know, my son and his, now he has three children, it just makes me so happy that they're able to do that. And there's nothing like new life to, you know, just affirm the value of life and the meaning of life.
Is it a matter of finding ways each day to kind of bring Matt into that day?
Well, I think at first it was intentional. I had to, you know, I had to work at it. And I think now it's more spontaneous. I think of him every day and various things remind me of him, looking at a plate of beautiful food or, you know, looking at the sun coming up and thinking of him paddling in a kayak across a body of water. I feel happy to have shared his life and, you know, I feel at peace with it.
Barbara Munger, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about your son, Matt.
You're welcome.
Milwaukeean Barbara Munger is the award-winning author of Riding Through Grief, published by Point Comfort Press. It's now available as an ebook. Munger is also an artist and the author of Mary Knoll, Inside and Outside. You can find a link to the Remembering Matt website from ours, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then a local tennis school is working with young players on the mental aspects of the game. That's coming up next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Much of the sporting world is focused on Brazil, where the World Cup teams have been reduced to the final 16. But there's also another world-class sporting event going on right now, Wimbledon. And for a solo athlete like a tennis player, being at the top of your physical and mental game is a big deal, especially considering there's no one else to lean on when you're having a bad day. Well, one local tennis school is such a believer in the mental aspects of the equation that they're building it into their curriculum. Jimmy Paley runs the Paley Tennis Center in Glendale, which has brought on a sports psychologist, Rainer Meisterjahn. As they tell Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, the mental side of the sport is a huge part of the game.
You can teach the strokes, but ultimately, well, when you get on the court and you're playing in a tournament, you have to be able to manage your emotions. You have to be able to dig deep to that inner belief that you have what it takes to win a match. And when it's in tennis, it's just you out there. So you have to find those inner beliefs and that courage and that calmness all on your own.
Does that make the mental aspects a bigger part of the equation than in a team sport?
I'm not sure if it makes it a bigger part, but it certainly makes for a different dynamic than you would have in a team sport. And in some ways, it does create a bigger challenge for the individual because he or she can't rely on teammates to bail them out if things are not going the way they wanted to. So certainly, speaking to what Jimmy mentioned, I think the mental part is just such an extremely important, undervalued part of the game of tennis. When I've spoken with professional athletes across all sports, most will say that the mental part is about 70 to 90% of their performance. Now, it's difficult to really measure whether or not that's true, but I think we can all agree that it's a large part, and thus it's one that we need to consciously and actively train and work on.
Well, right. You watch any number of sports on television, and you hear about the idea that people made mental errors out there, and that was what cost them the game or the match or the point or what have you.
Yeah, certainly. And Jimmy can probably speak more to that with his experience on the pro tour and his experience coaching players at various levels over the years. Absolutely.
Well, so Jimmy Paley, you work with tennis players of a variety of levels. How much different is your approach when you're working with a player who's really still just trying to get the physical part of the game down as well?
Well, I think the biggest difference is when the kids start and they're young, they're very innocent. And they're really just playing the game out of love of the game. And then once they start to improve, their expectations on themselves start to change. And they start becoming, well, they start believing that maybe they can play professional tennis, or people start telling them that they can. And once those expectations start to change, then a whole new set of pressures start to happen. And that's where I think it's very important that you have a good support system around you. You know how to handle and manage those new emotions that you're feeling and those new expectations that you're putting on yourself. And that's where if you can't do it on your own, somebody like Dr. Rainer Meisterjahn can help the child or the adult move through that.
Well, and I wonder if there's a pivotal moment in there from what you were just saying, this idea that people are telling you when you're a young person that you could be a professional tennis player or a professional athlete of any sport. Is really the key moment here when it goes from people telling you this to the point that you're actually believing this?
No doubt about it. And we have so many external influence that we have to pay attention to as we help these young aspiring players, you know, move to the next level. And these influences are parents, coaches, and just a lot of external voices that certainly create really many of these pivotal moments throughout a kid's development as they move on to that next level. Now, going back to your earlier question, I think the main difference to me between a young, aspiring, inexperienced tennis player and an adult player is that oftentimes young kids haven't formed habits yet. Now, that can be good and that can be a bad thing. I think it's a benefit really from my perspective in that you can teach them some of these mental skills at a young age and help these kids integrate them into their repertoire of tools that they can take out on the tennis court, whereas with an adult, it's really difficult sometimes to break habits, and it just takes more time because they've gotten so many reps over the years doing things a certain way.
Well, and obviously people aren't going to figure this out through a 10-minute radio interview, but can you talk about what some of those specific mental skills that you work on with a young tennis player are and how you at least start them off on working on those skills?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that about 85-90% of the athletes that I deal with come to me because they want to improve their confidence. So that's certainly one of the major skills that I work on with these kids. And we do that by setting very specific goals and by shifting the focus to controllable aspects of the game rather than ones you do not have complete control over.
Okay. Such as?
Such as, for instance, if you're playing against somebody that's clearly superior to you, maybe somebody that is more experienced, more accomplished, you can't control whether or not you win every single point, obviously. But what you can control is your body language. What you can control is how you talk to yourself internally after good and after bad points.
Is there a difference between confidence and cockiness?
I certainly think there is. I think confidence is much more controlled, whereas cockiness oftentimes means that you're overestimating your abilities.
This is what you were talking about with controlling your emotions out there?
Well, I think it's really critical that you learn to control your emotions because in a tennis match, there's so many ups and downs, not only in a tennis match, in a tennis career. And I think the more even-keeled you can be, the more you can weather the storm and persevere in that match or in a career.
We hear a lot about the idea of being a good winner and a good loser. Is part of the mental aspect taking lessons from your losses?
Absolutely. Some of the best lessons you learn are really from your losses. But, you know, I coach some of the best players in the United States and a few that are playing on the Pro Tour currently. And you know, when they were juniors and I was working with them, we would sit down after every match and specifically after the matches they would lose. And we'd go over what was it that they didn't do right and what can we work on so that the next time we play, you know, we can do it right. And, you know, it's interesting because I think so often we sit down and we look at what they did right and wrong from a physical standpoint. How was your forehand? How was your backhand? You know, how was your first serve percentage? But now we're going to really start to focus on the mental game, not just looking at what you're doing right and wrong from a physical standpoint, but how can you improve your mental game?
Well, really interesting stuff. Jimmy Paley, Reiner Meister-Jahn, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Jimmy Paley runs the Paley Tennis Center in Glendale and Paley Tennis Camp in Fredonia. Dr. Reiner Meister-Jahn is a sports psychologist and owner of Cortex Performance in Milwaukee. Our interview with them first aired in April, and they spoke with Mitch Teich. And that is all the time we have today. I am Bonnie North, and I thank you, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.